So I want to reflect a little bit this morning on teachers and teachers and students on this Zen path, a long and wonderful tradition of teachers who have left words and whose students have left us words, and we study these texts as pointers, and some of us here take the role of teacher and speak, and these meetings, teacher and student, we meet, and again and again we say there are no Zen teachers in America or in China, that what we are encountering is not what the teacher says, but anyway, to look at this a little bit through some of the words of Lin Shi we have been studying. He says, if you are able to put an end to thinking that chases after external objects, you will see that there is no difference between you yourselves and our teacher, the Buddha. Do you want to know who our teacher, the Buddha, is? The Buddha is you yourselves who are standing before me, listening to me teach the Dharma. The practitioner who does not have enough self-confidence will always direct his attention to what is external and wander around and around looking for something. Later on, he says, you should stop the mind which is always wandering around, running to the neighbor's house to study Zen, to learn the way, looking for a sentence, looking for words, seeking the master, seeking the Buddha, seeking a good spiritual friend. And even slightly later on, he says, my friends, if you hold to the words of the Zen masters and say that they constitute the true path, if you say these masters are good spiritual friends of inconceivable capacities, and if at the same time you think that your own mind is so profane you can't dare to estimate them, then you truly are blind. You will carry this prejudice complex with you all your life. You cannot see what your own eyes could show you. So a funny teaching that teachers, that Lin Ji says, and we repeat his words, not to seek after teachers or the teaching. And we've spoken often too about this self-confidence, Lin Ji's encouragement that we believe in ourselves, and of course not believe in our opinion. I think it was Bob who in one of his talks talked about having no self-confidence, confidence in this true person of no position, having confidence in something that is more than us. We could call it the Dharma, or God, or life. But we're encouraged again and again in the teachings of you hear and you read, encouraged to not believe someone else. Now, it's a paradoxical command when we say, don't believe me. Because if you believe that, then you don't. But anyway, it gets kind of complicated. But I think maybe this is all Zen teaching, is some kind of lights and mirrors. And if we take this teaching literally, we end up in the position of the Dharma bums. Jack Kerouac and friends in the 50s first heard about Zen, says, well, don't need a teacher, everything's right here. Let's just have a good time. I'm trying to think what's wrong with that. well, actually, it's quite hard to do. We hear these teachings and we can say, oh yeah, that's really true. But the mind, the intellectual mind that says this is true is so different from having this insight for ourselves. So this wisdom we seek is nowhere else other than here, and yet it is so clouded over. For all of this, our ancient twisted karma, all of the conditions and circumstance that have given us shape in this life and given us life, we all have our delusions, and we are all quite attached to our delusion. We are all quite confident in our delusion. And the Buddha taught that one of the primary delusions is thinking that we don't have what we need. Yes, we can wander around, but these the winds of karma, the habit force is so strong, the trance of everyday life pulls us in, and we're lost. So we say in this practice that that effort is required, and all of us have tasted something beyond the dream. You do not come to practice Zen unless there is something you have tasted or something you have guessed at or something that you long for. But maybe we read a book and something touches us, or maybe we hear a teacher talk and something in us recognizes what is true. True not because the teacher said it, but because our heart knows that this is true. In the last piece I read, Lin Shi said, "My friends, if you hold to the words of the Zen masters and say they constitute a path, if you say these masters are good spiritual friends of inconceivable capacities, and that your own mind is so profane you can't dare estimate them, then you are blind." So there is a real danger when we hear the Dharma, and a real danger when we work with teachers, that we can give up our self. And for many of us, we are so eager to give up our self. We are so sure that we are not it. We do not have it, whatever it is they're talking about. And so it's quite human when we hear someone who appears to have some energy, to have some understanding. And I think when we encounter teachers, there are many teachers who have clearly uncovered something, clearly have something that they know. And yet we have to be so careful. So careful in to continue to verify for ourselves. Earlier in the Lin Shi passage, he says, "Do not seek for the transcendent will come to you." The original Chinese was more, "Do not seek for the 10 wonderful things, the 10 wonderful things will come to you." And there was a traditional list of 10 wonderful things, which included powers of knowing what was coming, and these we call them siddhis, these spiritual powers. And as we practice this way, there are powers that come to us. There are intuitions or understanding, and there are many teachers in this world, both of Zen and teachers of other traditions, that when you're around them, you feel something. You say, oh my God, this person knows something. Sometimes there is a certainty. Someone says, this is how it is, and you can trust me. And we want so much for that certainty. And yet, so many teachers in Zen and on other paths have used their power toward their own ends. I did study briefly, went on a few retreats with Sasaki Roshi, who passed away just in the past year or two. A Rinzai master who had several centers out in California. And certainly a man of great depth and insight, a Dharmakaya master. But throughout the course of his life, we found out, we know that he was continually sexually abusing women. As I met with him, it was clear to me I was meeting with someone who could see deeply into the human realm. And yet this seeing deeply did not prevent him from acting out some of the most basic instincts of greed and selfishness, and using his great powers for his own pleasure. People like this are so dangerous because there is something that is there, and we want to give ourselves to trust. And people like this will say, you can trust me. If you put your trust in me, I will give you everything. Do not believe anyone who says they will give you everything. No one can give you everything. And in the case of Sasaki Roshi, he had so many devoted students, both men and women, who protected him. And when someone would come forward and say, this is wrong, a teacher should not be groping his women students. They would be disempowered. They would be told that everything is okay in the Dharma, and that this person is so enlightened that he is able to do this with no blame. So through the power of his samadhi, through the power of something, Sasaki Roshi was able to continue to behave in this really terrible and abusive way for decades. And only as he was on his deathbed were people truly able to come forward, and he has since died, passed on, leaving great pain and confusion in his wake. How could someone with such deep powers be so blind? And then everyone in the organization left thinking, how could we let this happen? It's like the blinders come off. Sasaki Roshi, I think, just won particularly egregious case, but in all cases, as a teacher, of course, even as a professor or teacher of anything, but especially in the Zen path, there is such power and such intimacy in playing this role. And so many teachers have fallen prey to their own blindness. The realm of the Dharmakaya is indeed wonderful and is indeed beyond compare. And yet, as Melissa spoke so beautifully yesterday about the need for balance, and I think perhaps this is one of the innovations in Zen that is happening as we practice, that is happening as Zen comes to the West, to try to continue to honor teachers and the teaching, to honor the great oneness which knows no right or wrong, is not inflected plus or minus, just pure spaciousness. But to realize that this is only a partial view. Now, of course, in the koans and in the Zen literature, this is stressed again and again. How do you take a step off the 100-foot pole? When you have some understanding, when you have some sense of peace and safety, some sense of presence and ease, how do you not get seduced? These states of openness are such gifts, such blessings that come, but they are also such a difficulty too. Because for most of us, we can understand being willing to let go of the difficult times, loosening our grip, sort of letting it come and go. But when we taste the nectar of the gods, when we, as you were saying last night, when our mind finally releases us, we realize that these teachings are actually true. There is nothing to do. When we realize this, all we want is to stay here in the arms of God. And we want to fixate, and we want it to be like this forever. And we will now begin to protect this, and can get into great trouble. So the need, whatever experience arises, to allow it to come and allow it to go. And when we encounter the Dharma in a teacher, we can notice what arises in us. As Diane spoke so beautifully earlier in the retreat of upon awakening, thinking that this awakening or this opening came because of the power of the teacher. But to see that this power to wake up does not reside outside of us. It is not given to us. It is not bestowed on us by some other being. But this is our birthright. And we can appreciate whatever attainments, whatever gifts other people have. But we should not put our trust in them. We should listen and receive what teaching and then verify for ourselves. The purpose of our Zen practice is not about becoming like our teacher. And there's a wonderful reading about this. I wanted to read from Uchiyama Roshi. So Uchiyama is the teacher of Okamura. Okamura is a wonderful writer and teacher. Actually, Jason has had the good fortune to study with him. Actually, not good fortune. He decided he would go out there and study with him. But he has written some of the texts we read in our book. And Uchiyama wrote this wonderful book, Opening the Hand of Thought. And Uchiyama is talking about his teacher, Sawaki Roshi. And he said, throughout his life, Sawaki Roshi said, Zazen is good for nothing. In 1941, I was ordained and became one of his disciples. Soon after, while walking with him, I asked, I am such a timid person. If I study under your guidance and practice Zazen with you for many years until you pass away, can I become even a little bit stronger? He replied immediately, no, you can't. No matter how hard and how long you practice, Zazen is good for nothing. I didn't become who I am as a result of Zazen. By nature, I was this kind of person. On this point, I haven't changed at all. When I heard his response, I thought, although Roshi says so with his mouth, if I continue to practice Zazen, I must be able to become a better person. He says, lately I've been reflecting on my past, and now I understand that Zazen really is good for nothing. I'm still a coward, and never became even a little bit like Sawaki Roshi. So we might think that we should be more like the teacher or someone else. And we look to them, we give away our treasure. So this whole encouragement around teachers and teaching is to hear the teaching, to receive the teaching from the center of your being. So we listen to Dharma talks in our Zazen posture, staying with ourself, no need to even understand the Dharma talk, but allowing whatever is true for you, whatever resonates, whatever touches you, and believing in the truth of this resonance. And so the Dharma you encounter is not my Dharma or Melissa's or anyone's, but the Dharma you encounter is your Dharma. You encounter yourself, and the true teacher are not these words. The Buddha outside you is not the teacher. Linchi says, kill that Buddha. The teacher is not the one sitting up here blabbing on and on. But the teacher is your life. Each breath in, each breath out, the miraculous functioning of life that you are manifesting. Teachers can be so important to only to reflect back to you what you already have. Never from the very beginning were you ever lacking anything at all. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. And welcome comments, considerations, questions. Yeah.
I guess I don't want to take exception with great masters, but...
Yes, that's exactly what you're supposed to do.
This concept of Zazen is good for nothing, and I'll still be the same person. It seems like so much of who I am is the result of my chasing after external things, that that with practice, there better be a change. but I think that there is, and I don't know. And so I kind of, that rubbed me a little. I guess I kind of know what they're talking about, and I kind of think, well, maybe not so much.
What's the truth of that, John? So what, like if you were going to say...
I think that the truth is perhaps that practice allows you to be who you really are, and that's not that it's not there all along, but you're so busy, or I'm so busy, chasing after or worrying about, that person doesn't emerge very often. And so, perceptibly, I'm hoping that there might be a change to come. But I think that's perhaps where that resonates for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna be this lively, you know, person who's, you know, the center of attention at a party. I'm not going to change in that way, but perhaps I won't cower in a corner worrying if people are talking about me or something.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And again, if we get a fixed position, we're in trouble. And there's actually, let me just read the quote from Sasaki, what he wrote. So he said, "What is Zen good for? Nothing. We should hear that all the time. Practice good for nothing, Zen, without any expectation. Otherwise, our practice really is good for nothing."
That's from Sasaki.
Sawaki, yeah. So I think there's good for nothing and good for nothing. And I like what you're saying, that hopefully what emerges in our Zazen is who we've been all along. And when we stop trying to be someone else, it can be such a relief. And as we practice, I do believe we can become more fearlessly who we are. And that is a huge difference and no change at all. Yeah, Joyce.
I just think some of these the teachings must be a relief to you guys, that you don't have to be the guru there, you know, the one that is the one who teaches, and that somehow there must be a relief in that. And the other day I was actually writing to a friend of mine, and you know, why am I coming here? And I said, well, I don't really know, but it's very close to my house. That's a good reason. And it's only 5 minutes away. And I think the teachers know something about the path, but more importantly, they follow the precepts, so I feel safe. You know? And I'm thinking about that story of Suzuki.
Sasaki.
Sasaki. Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, when you have those kind of openings, those boundaries are gone. You know, so then that can be hard to maintain. That's happened with a lot in some other people in all traditions, all religious traditions, and. You know, I think that the warning is really still have to be careful. Mm-hmm. And never lose oneself mm-hmm. in a teacher.
Well, and you know, we will lose ourselves. Even teachers lose themselves. It can be very cruel and unkind when we get caught in this Dharmakaya realm. You know, when David was trotting off to see Sasaki Roshi, I already knew his reputation. It was actually, it was one of these things that the people closest to him were in denial about it, but everybody else knew about it. So I said, I would never be with a person like that. It was such a flaunting of everything that I hold important in Zen, and a privileging of Dharmakaya over everything else. You know, and it created a lot of conflict in my own heart. Because, you know, boy, David and his teacher, George, would just go on and on about how warm and loving he was. And I said, yeah, warm and loving, but I don't want him to fondle my breast. Thank you very much. You know, no matter how warm and loving he is. I didn't buy it. And I think what you're pointing to is something that everyone has to struggle with. And for some reason, I liked what David said about how his students protected him. They protected him from actually flowering fully as a human being. Right? That which is a danger. You know, idealization will get in the way of that. And we can be so full of ourselves as teachers, you know, that we can actually say things that really go right into the wound place. Now, that might be a good thing or a bad thing. Certainly will cause something to happen. But we have to be attentive to it, right? It's not just about oneness. It's not just about, you know, everyone being uncovered. It's also about everyone being held. And so this balance of wisdom, you know, that Sasaki was a Manjushri teacher, a Dharmakaya teacher, cut through everything. And compassion welled up from him. And maybe not so much Nirmanakaya, Samantabhadra energy, right? He couldn't actually actualize it fully because he was a human being, not a god. So this is ongoing practice. It never ends, and everyone is in the same boat. And if we can avoid being unkind, that's great. But I don't think it's always possible. You know, people just get lost. We all get lost. So then we have to be very forgiving of each other. We have to look into our own hearts and see where we've been unkind. You know, it's just massive, right? So I love that you admire what we're doing. And it is great that it's only 5 minutes away. That's karma. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's actually only a minute away from me. but it's so we don't know why we do what we do, and once we all come together, there's this amazing responsibility we have, and we will fall down. We definitely will fall down. We'll make lots of mistakes. So we're trying to cultivate a sangha. Maybe this is what you feel, where we support each other in being fully human, as we are, and also this possibility of that we're already Buddhists. How could that be? Like this? Cowering in the corner, afraid to talk to people at parties? Could this be the activity of a Buddha? Yes. Yes. More, did you have more?
Yeah, because I want this to sound respectful, and I'm hoping that it'll be freeing. But I don't idealize you guys at all.
Yay! So, we've succeeded.
Respect.
Yeah, yeah.
Appreciation.
Yeah.
But you know, so I'm only saying that with the deepest respect, and not so that it'll be freeing for you.
Yeah.
You know. Because I think the whole role of a teacher could also be a daunting responsibility and scary, and everything that David was talking about, it can go to your head, you know.
Yeah.
But, so, anyway, I just wanted to put that out there. I hope it's within the respectful, appreciative tone that I wanted it to be.
Yeah,
it was. Okay. Yes, that's how it was received. And just on the other side, There are still some people who idealize us. And that's okay, too. They'll get over it eventually. But, people do... That's part of the process sometimes. We're not yet ready to see that, so it's not a problem either. Yeah. But great, thanks.
Yeah, Marie Pierre and then Brett.
For me, in fact, for example, the reason why I'm here, it's I don't have the choice. It's a movement in myself who tell me you have to go.
Yeah.
So, and it's like if I have meeting with myself sometimes, and I have to let everything and follow this intuition.
Yeah.
But what you say is true, because particularly today, I'm like if I was drunk, completely drunk, or like if I have taken drugs. So it's very important to feel safe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, these retreats are, you know, we do encounter all of these states where it's hard to remember who we are or what, you know, the boundaries get very fuzzy. And I think that's why for us as teachers and leaders, you know, we have such an obligation to create a place where it's okay to be vulnerable. And I think why it's especially... I think harmful in spiritual communities where the teachers promise that and then don't fulfill that. This place where you can follow your intuition and you can fall apart. We can all become disorganized. There still is this container that will support us, we can trust. Thank you.
Just on that vulnerability, yeah. I think what was a big source of confusion for me for a long time was I knew that vulnerability was necessary in order to practice. Mm. And I felt that it was necessary to be vulnerable with the teacher, you know, to be willing to come forward and be honest and as open as I could be. And what has changed a little bit for me is learning that I need to be vulnerable with all of life, so not just with the teacher. Shift makes it possible, I think, to remember this self-confidence that Linji talks about, you know, to hold that with great appreciation and to know that the opening is to all of our experience, not just with one person.
Yeah.
I think that's really true. Mm. And I think also part of the function of a teacher is sometimes to be that first person, right, who shows the way to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But I just love what you're saying, because it's got to, if it only stays with that teacher, then you have a recipe for all kinds of terrible stuff, which we know.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Not between us. We're talking about another teacher we both studied with.
Yeah. So, thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm about to commit heresy here. But in my opinion, if a view can lead to somebody doing something destructive, it seems like, or like if some piece of information or perspective can lead to somebody doing something bad, that's not a good perspective. It's a potentially destructive, or in some cases, actually destructive. I've sort of been, and maybe I'm sort of over clinging onto these concepts of Dharmakaya, Nirmanakaya, and Sambhogakaya, but I really get to, and I have a lot of doubts about the value of the third one.
Which ones do you get?
The Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya are great. I feel like I've gotten a taste of what this Dharmakaya stuff is about. But if I sort of think about them on balance, mm-hmm. I think sexual assault and whatever I've had an experience of, mm-hmm. Sexual assault's much worse than that is good.
Well, and I think it's one of the issues then that you bring up is, how do we deal with the teachings of teachers who are, who have ethical violations, who are sexual abusers? How do we deal with by extension then, how do we deal with the teachings of anyone who is blind? I think it's a real question. Because ultimately, every teacher will disappoint you. But there's some teachers that do these egregious behaviors, really blind. And does that invalidate all the teaching? So, there's certainly almost, you know, so many Zen teachers who have crossed ethical lines with students. And if we threw all of their writings and teachings out, we might be missing something. But your point is well taken. If someone can't live their teachings, or worse than that, if someone behaves in a violent and damaging way, what does that mean about anything that person says?
And I would say, add to that, to just reframe your concern a little bit, because I don't think it's about good and bad views. I don't think the Dharmakaya is a bad view and Sambhogakaya is a good view. But I think any one of them taken alone is incomplete. Mm. And in the incompleteness, that's where the harm arises. I've seen many teachers who are Nirmanakaya teachers and have no truck with Sambhogakaya or Dharmakaya. And the harm that they do is there's sort of a deadening of what it means to be a human being. It's just walk mindfully, you know, eat slowly. But there's no joy. There's like this deadness. And it causes great suffering. You can be a Nirmanakaya teacher alone and make a justification for sexual abuse. Because every activity is it, you know. Right. So let's be mindful while I fondle your breast. You know that. Oh, you can just feel how awful that is because it's narrow. It's incomplete. I've also seen great harm from Sambhogakaya teachers. Purely Sambhogakaya. Everything is so wonderful. Oh wow! There's nothing but beauty and joy and bliss and the dream world, and everything is up for grabs. And you can see the harm that that would do. So from my point of view, and what I've had to do for myself is keep seeing. You know, we've been talking all day about no lack, and yet there is imbalance. And the possibility for human beings is to open to every view, ultimately. And I want to be with people who have a different view than me, so that we can enjoy each other's views, and then it becomes more complete. So I think what you're saying is so important, and I think what you're pointing to is incompleteness, not wrongness. Yeah. So you don't have to believe me. Uh-oh, just did a double bind on you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Steve.
So it seems that there's a strange imbalance here. So Zen practice won't make you stronger, but great depth of samadhi and experience of the Dharmakaya may corrupt you and turn you into a monster. Seems like a very difficult thing to say. Couldn't it be the case that Suzaki was this sort of person from the beginning?
Yes.
And that there's an inherent difficulty in being a spiritual teacher. Mm-hmm. Right? That this is a very dangerous position for any person to put themselves in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you were teaching Christianity right. or Judaism or whatever spiritual practice it might be, it is dangerous for people to put you on a pedestal as a spiritual teacher.
Yeah.
Well, and does it have anything to do with the depth of his samadhi power? Right. Is that what corrupted? Did that turn him into this person?
Yeah. I have an opinion.
Yeah.
You know, having encountered him remotely, but also had a teacher who was very much like him for many years, this is what I'm basing this on. You know, I had to work through all these issues, the same kind of issues. What is it, Dharmakaya, that's doing this? Or is it an underlying condition that finds... an opportunity, right? So being a teacher is really hard, by the way. I just have to say, you know, Joyce was pointing it out, because not just because of idealization, but there is power involved. So if we're narcissists or sociopaths, it's a perfect job description for a narcissist or sociopath. Right. Wow, I'm going to have all this power over people and manipulate them, either consciously or unconsciously. Very attractive. I think that what you're pointing to is really, really well said, and I hadn't quite thought about it before just that clearly, but we all come into this practice as we are, and we will be that person forever, as John was pointing out, and if we use the teachings to support the narrow self, then you see all the damage that can be done. Yeah, and we see it everywhere. You know, people in the prison population who become leaders in prison. You know, through they have a certain kind of spiritual power. It's quite tricky. So, yeah, just to take this into a completely different place, I've been reading a lot of Chodyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and he was a person also who totally messed up, and yet. I wouldn't throw out his teachings. His teachings are brilliant. And he was an alcoholic and a womanizer, you know. So, but the little piece I was just reading from him, which I think was sort of exposing something of his own wound, is saying that everybody in the world has a chink in their armor. Everybody has it. And he even said sociopaths dictators. And everybody has this little tiny place. And sometimes it just comes up as, I like ice cream. The little chink, like a positive, you know, the flow of human nature at its best coming through. So even in the most convoluted places, it's, you know, I like this kind of ice cream. And the part of our job as people of the way is to see where that place is in ourselves. And it's also a wound because it's an opening. It's a little place where the armor gets, you know, you can thrust something in there and hurt it. And we want to widen it and see that it can never be hurt. It can only be lived from. So I think people who use the Dharma, the teachings, to protect that little wound, that's what we're trying not to do here. And it goes back to what Diane was saying about vulnerability. If you can see that in, you know, if I can see that in myself, the little place where I get wounded easily, to just expose that to the light, it hurts at first, and then it turns into wisdom, compassion, and enlightened activity, without me doing it. So it's that sort of exposure that's important, and it can go wrong. Human beings, look at the history of the world. How many human beings have been free from from violence, right? It's everywhere. It's part of our inheritance. And I feel like we have to own it. And then, I think, Joyce, you mentioned the precepts. Without the precepts, it would be a very difficult way. We couldn't practice, I don't think. And both these teachers we're talking about, our former teacher, Richard Clark, and Sasaki Roshi, only saw the precepts from the Dharmakaya point of view. And that's, again, that's that incomplete view that Abe was pointing to.
So we're going to have to stop here. Yeah. But I want to acknowledge that we're in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. Right? I feel kind of unsettled by all this. and want to appreciate that as this is not something to be fixed, but something to investigate. And I am so grateful for all of you sitting here that we can come together to investigate this, to be ourselves, to see what arises and trust. So whatever is in your heart now hearing this, no need to figure it out. Let it be there. It will teach you, true teacher, here at every moment. So let's take a couple breaths and then we'll go into walking.